You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 22 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we're joined by a special guest today.
Katie Caracino, who will be here talking with us about the biggest day in Seattle gathering history.
That's a very specific thing, but I can't deny that it's
true. It's not the biggest day in Seahawk history. It's probably not the biggest day in Seattle history, but it's the biggest group of people who have ever gathered together and watched people ride slowly by in history. And had Skittles semi-violently thrown at them.
It surpassed the 79 Sonics parade and surpassed the Seafair parade, so yeah.
It was the day of the Seahawks parade in downtown Seattle. An estimated 700,000 people were there.
I counted. It was like 698,921.
Oh, really?
So they rounded up a little bit.
Did you count us, though?
Oh, no, I gotta start all over again. Wait, did someone move?
That's a really good joke.
You laughed really hard at it.
I laugh at everything while we're recording a podcast.
We should mention briefly before we get into the parade, today also National Signing Day. We have a lot of thoughts on that, as you would imagine, and we split that off into a separate podcast, so be sure to check that out after you're finished listening to this.
Yes, much like all of sports radio, all of news media, every possible bit of media you could get from Seattle, we split off National Signing Day and tucked it aside.
Yep.
And are focusing in on the Seahawks and their big day today.
Yep. It really was hyped as the biggest event, but the thing was, it kind of lived up to the hype. I mean, there was all the talk about what a big problem was going to be in terms of traffic and getting there, and I think we quickly realized that that was going to be the case as we started driving there and saw every single bus stop you passed, there was a half a dozen to a dozen Seahawks fans waiting to get on the bus, some of them trying to hitchhike with us.
I realized it while we were walking for over an hour to get to the stadium.
That was a pretty good tip-off.
But as far as takeaways from the parade itself, I think that this being my first ever championship parade, it's not really that thrilling of a thing to watch.
No, it's kind of just people driving past. And this is why I don't attend parades on a regular basis.
And we've seen we've seen these people a lot, and we're used to watching them doing something that they're really good at in playing football, but not necessarily standing and waving.
Also, I thought Marshawn Lynch was pretty good.
Marshawn Lynch was the only redeeming, not the only, but he was the most redeeming factor of the championship parade. Marshawn Lynch was receiving Skittles and then throwing Skittles into the crowd, at some point got some sort of Native American drum and was banging on it. And was sitting all alone in the very first part of the first float of the parade, which also had the seagulls in it. And then there was Marshawn Lynch sitting on the hood, throwing his Skittles and banging his drum.
He was basically the Grand Marshal of the championship parade. There's no other way to put it.
It's kind of an awesome scenario for Marshawn, because he doesn't have to like say anything or be too particularly public, but he can express his personality in that way. And that was the best part of the parade portion of it.
I think what's amazing is, so the ratio is, there was probably 15 to 20 minutes of you actually see the players and everyone else involved in the parade, local politicians, other members of the organization.
I was thrilled to see Jay Inslee.
And now Constantine really got a huge hand. But you're waiting there for 2 to 3 hours to see this 20 minutes. And the fact that people were so excited to do this in freezing temperatures really speaks to kind of what the Seahawks have done to this community.
Yeah, the thing that we learned was that people really like the Seahawks right now.
An amazing fact. I mean, it's just, like, it's mind-blowing that 4 years ago they couldn't sell out games, and now they're getting 700,000 people for a parade.
Absolutely. And then, so, for season ticket holders, there was an event that was going on inside CenturyLink Field, kind of a celebration with speeches and things like that. And I thought that was more interesting than watching people drive by semi-quickly. And I thought the really cool part was they introduced every single player on the team, including like practice squad players who've been on IR for most of the season. I thought that was really cool.
Some players we were meeting for the very first time.
Yeah, the ones who I didn't even recognize what their name was. A couple of them was like, me and Chris looked at each other like, I don't know.
I think there was only one I didn't
recognize. No idea. And so they counted down from number 99. It was really cool for every player to get recognized and cheered. And then they brought out all of the coaches, and then they brought out Pete Carroll, and saved, for very last, Russell Wilson carrying out the championship trophy.
Now, who do you think got a bigger round of applause? Russell Wilson or Pete Carroll?
Russell Wilson, partially because he was carrying the trophy.
Yeah, I mean, that added to it. But I thought it was awfully close. Pete Carroll is a god at this point in Seattle.
I thought it was really strange that it wasn't Pete carrying out the trophy. When they didn't introduce Russell, when they were going down the numbers, obviously he's the lowest number on the team. But I was surprised that I was expecting him to come out last after all the coaches and everybody, and then Pete to come out with the trophy. But I thought maybe it was a nice gesture on Pete's behalf to have Russell come out with the championship trophy.
It really spoke to the leadership position that he's assumed on this team, even at such a young age.
Sophomore year, and he's bringing out a Super Bowl championship trophy to a crowd of 50,000 people. After his head coach, after the owner of the team, after all of the other coaches. I thought that was really strange.
It was interesting to see him and Paul Allen interact in a way that just, like, you know, you wouldn't expect for a 24-year-old and a billionaire who's the owner of the team. Like, it was just totally, they're on the same level somehow.
But, I mean, you would definitely expect that from Russell Wilson.
Yeah, I mean, he's a politician, basically.
He's kissing babies up there, shaking hands.
It is kind of disappointing that the presidential support now has shifted to Richard Sherman, as Maria Cantwell had the Sherman for president side.
But I do think it was partially, you know, Russell Wilson, throughout the lead-up to the Super Bowl, he didn't get recognized probably as much as he should have, because there was so much conversation about Richard Sherman, and then Malcolm Smith winning the MVP award. So I thought it was really nice for Russell Wilson to have kind of a hero's welcome back with this championship trophy.
Absolutely. The other guy that really stood out in terms of reaction is our friend Jermaine Kearse got a huge round of applause. And then throughout, they had a highlight montage preceding the actual presentation. And so many big plays from Jermaine Kearse throughout the season, culminating in his touchdown in the Super Bowl.
Yes, as I foresaw at the beginning of the year.
Didn't we all foresee that Jermaine Kearse, a drafted free agent, would have touchdowns in both the NFC Championship game and the Super Bowl?
He was disproportionately, I would say that Kearse and Doug Baldwin were disproportionately in the highlight video from the season.
Yeah, that's fair.
And then another cool part, after they introduced the whole team, basically they began a game, right? They did the whole normal intro that they would do, and then raising the 12th man flag, you knew it was going to be somebody because it was down when he walked into the stadium. And that was Big Walt Jones, who was just elected in the Hall of Fame last week.
Watching outside, I had no idea that was coming, so that was kind of a surprise and a very pleasant one.
I thought it was really cool. Arguably, but probably the best player in Seahawks history, gets to raise the 12th man flag at the Super Bowl celebration.
And I think the big thing is, otherwise we wouldn't really have had a chance to celebrate Walt Jones' election to the Hall of Fame is a city until next, you know, August or September. So that was cool to have that days later.
And we'll be playing here on a Thursday night to begin the 2014 NFL season.
Presumably.
And they have Macklemore in their back pocket.
Yeah.
And I thought they were definitely going to use Macklemore for the 12th man flag at some point during this playoffs, and didn't do it in either of the playoff home games, and then now not at the Super Bowl celebration.
Would you do Macklemore or Macklemore and Ryan Lewis? Should Ryan Lewis be there as
would
well?
I do Macklemore? I would do them both.
We've got enough track here.
but definitely Macklemore and Ryan Lewis. Everything that they do is as a table.
Exactly.
What does Ryan Lewis do, though?
He just stands there hyping
there
him
with
up.
His arms crossed. Okay.
He plays the music.
The symbol.
Yeah.
Giant symbol.
You'd be in with Blue Thunder?
Yeah.
But I thought it was really cool for Big Walt to be part of that celebration.
Absolutely.
Especially not winning a Super Bowl ring of his own, despite kind of being close one time and being closer a few times also. Any other takeaways from this, or...
Well, what stood out to me was just how much talk there was about winning more championships. Yeah. And I have a lot of experience covering sports teams and a little bit of experience covering championship teams. And in the case of the Storm, it was very much in the moment. You know, this is a great thing, and then we'll worry about next season going forward. But the Seahawks have been very open about embracing that... You know, we want this to be the start of something very big in terms of, you know, the term dynasty even is getting thrown around. And a lot of talk about coming back and doing this again next year, which surprised me given how, how reluctant sports teams usually are, and especially coaches, to talk about that, some things that far into the future.
I mean, the thing that it seemed most like, you know, Pete Carroll talking about it, saying, this isn't the end, we're just getting started. We're just warming up here. But it definitely reminded you of the unveiling of Chris Bosh and LeBron James in Miami with his not one, not two, not three.
There was nothing that specific that was would be so easy for people to make fun of if you were losing next year.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they've definitely set expectations could not possibly, the bar could not possibly be set any higher for next year.
It really is true. I mean, I've been calling for the undefeated season next year for a little while.
Yeah, it's basically as high as you can put the.
So.
I mean, you haven't said that, you know, it's going to be a season-long shutout for the CIA. That would probably be
the
next step.
Next goal after the undefeated season. I'm saying it's going to be an undefeated season with the stipulation that Percy Harvin is healthy throughout the year.
Which, when was the last time that happened?
Not that long ago.
Okay, if you say so.
If Percy Harvin, we don't have to talk about this right now, but if Percy Harvin plays, we're going to repeat this in a year when we have the perfect season with Percy Harvin. If Percy Harvin plays each and every game, Seahawks are going undefeated next year.
I mean, I hope that Nostra Tristan is correct on this one.
You can't blame the team for feeling really excited about it, and they're looking at it from like kind of an analytical perspective, you know? They're looking at it from a perspective like, we're the second youngest team in the NFL and just won the Super Bowl.
Second youngest Super Bowl team ever. Youngest team to win the Super Bowl. And if you look at that list, it's a number of teams that went on to dominate for a period of years. Now, the big difference between those teams and the Seahawks is they played in the pre-salary cap era. And that's the big thing that the Seahawks are going to have to manage. Starting this offseason, really setting up, I think, for years to come, is these young draft picks that have been such great bargains start coming up for extensions and start making a lot more money.
Well, I mean, that's definitely true. You're going to lose players who are on this team right now, right?
Yeah.
Some of the star players on this team are going to go, but it's partially that you have so much faith in John Schneider and Pete Carroll that John Schneider is going to draft the right players. He's done it already.
He has.
And Pete Carroll is going to coach them correctly until he gets senile.
Yeah, Pete Carroll is in some ways the largest age concern on the team. At age 62.
I can't say that about Pete. He doesn't behave like a 62-year-old.
He doesn't operate on the same human concept of time as the rest of us.
It'll be a dynasty until things start going haywire for Pete and his mind.
Haywire.
Oh,
I'm not saying that.
But I mean, you look at it, and there's no way that you would say that Russell Wilson is done developing,
no.
Right? So you do have some players who, I mean, Marshawn Lynch is going to start wearing down. Some defensive players are going to go and have to be replaced with potentially players who are worse than them. But Russell Wilson is nowhere near his peak in his career.
Yeah, and I think that's the big evolution we're going to see over the next 3 to 4 years.
Jermaine Kearse is only a sophomore receiver.
That's true.
That's right.
I mean, I think I predicted this when we were doing our 2014 predictions way back when.
Perfect season?
No, it's not that. I predicted that Marshawn Lynch was not going to run for 1,000 yards next year and that Russell Wilson was going to finish in the top three in MVP voting, and that would be the start of kind of the evolution of the Seahawks from a run-first team to a pass-first team. And I think we kind of saw that in the Super Bowl a little bit, that it was a situation where Denver completely sold out to stop the run, and the Seahawks had no problem whatsoever just giving the ball to Russell Wilson and saying, go make plays against, admittedly, a limited secondary.
Yeah, I agree.
What do you guys think about the Golden Tate comments about him taking maybe a little bit less or something like that?
Well,
those
comments didn't come from his agent.
That's true.
I think that that's something right now. He's caught up in the moment of excitement.
Yeah.
I wouldn't.
But he also said he has a specific number in mind. So I think it's kind of what you'd expect from a player, where there is an element of a hometown discount, but you still got to take care of him.
I think that he's obviously not the Seahawks' first priority. Michael Bennett is the Seahawks' first priority.
Yeah.
Right? Releasing Cindy Rice might be their first priority. But Michael Bennett is the first person who they're going to try to take care of, and I think the Seahawks will definitely re-sign Michael Bennett.
And I think he's also the first domino because he's unrestricted. You have a little bit more flexibility with Tate as a restricted guy coming off his first contract. It's a little bit different situation with him.
But I think more so than even just specifically talking about Golden Tate, whether he'll be back or not, it's more the mentality where players around the NFL want to play in Seattle, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And this has been a conversation for a while, but you look at another team, so the 49ers go to the NFC Championship 3 consecutive years, right? But players aren't saying, I really want to go play for Jim Harbaugh. You know, they still get bargain players. Some of them are traded to him by his brother.
That's true.
You know, the 49ers are still going to get bargain players, but they're not going to get players who were in their prime at that cheaper level like the Seahawks did with both Cliff Averill and Michael Bennett.
I mean, I wouldn't put that all on Harbaugh. I mean, part of that, again, was the market and the way it worked out. The Seahawks had an opportunity because there wasn't a big offer that they were having to compete with. But the other aspect of it is just the organization as a whole, the fans, CenturyLink Stadium, VMAC and Renton, first class all the way. And you know, San Francisco with a new stadium coming up might be a little bit different competition than if they're telling you to go play in 40-year-old Candlestick Park.
But I do think that, that players really want to play here, and I think it might be something that drives Golden Tate sticking around.
Exactly.
I mean, the wide receiver core becomes pretty packed next year if he were to stick around, assuming you release
Baldwin also a free agent.
But Baldwin will be a huge priority also. Probably a bigger priority than Golden Tate, too. But if you look at it where you have potentially Harvin back, plus Baldwin, plus Curse, plus Tate, you know, that's pretty packed in there.
Well, I think you have to plan as if Harvin may not be available at times. And the other thing is, you know, I think that you slot guys into smaller roles, which is where they originally were supposed to be, and that just makes them all the more effective.
And this is the time period. It's the draft where you might look at selecting a wide receiver within the first four rounds as somebody who could potentially come in to replace some of these other receivers.
But I think that's the other thing about what you worry about going forward is the Seahawks' depth was such a strength this year, and especially you looked at it in the Super Bowl, where Denver was not as deep going into the season, also had many more injuries over the course of the year than the Seahawks did, and it really showed in the Super Bowl. The Seahawks were able to rotate on the defensive line quite a bit, and they were able to stay fresh, and that really helped them get to Peyton Manning. I think that was one of the things that helped produce Sunday's result.
I agree with you that the Seahawks have a lot of depth, but I have so much faith that they can continue to develop depth, right? How much faith do you have in Deshaun Sheet, you know? I have a lot of faith in every single player on that team. I have a lot of faith in Mike Morgan if they need to get down to their fifth linebacker. Think about how many defensive linemen you're confident in them playing really well in. You know, they signed Quint McDonald and Tony McDaniel, and they're two super important linemen for the team.
Yeah, and you also have guys coming up that did not, their draft class this year really didn't have much of an impact, and those guys I think next year you look at is taking a much larger role.
So I think that there's depth continuing to be on the way.
Hope so.
And just so much faith in really the coaching staff, and it's more about the system than it is even necessarily about the specific players.
All right, well, should we talk a little about Husky basketball before we go?
Yeah. It was a rough week this last week.
that's one
was,
way to put it.
It was actually a great week this last week.
Yeah.
But in Husky basketball terms, it was a rough week with a really rough loss in Pullman against Wazoo.
First off, Wazoo is a totally different team when they're fully healthy.
Yeah.
And that was a big factor in the game. They were so much more potent offensively. But beyond that, it just seemed like everything that could go wrong offensively kind of did.
Well, I thought it was kind of a case study in freshmen. And their playmaking ability, or just their consistency, I guess, with Nigel Williams-Goss having this great game the week before, and then just, I don't even remember what his stat line was, but it wasn't terrific. And,
it certainly wasn't 32 points.
Yeah. And so it's just kind of, he has a lot of potential, I think, for the next couple of years that he'll be here, but it was a freshman sort of game for him, and I think maybe, you know, Pullman, you know, the fans and the players kind of get hyped for that game because it's maybe one of the biggest games left on their schedule just because of the rivalry.
Without question.
And so they, you know, CJ said that they make up some interesting things in their, what is it, the kook pack? I don't know what they're...
I believe it's the Zoo Crew.
The Zoo Crew, that's right.
The Zoo Crew.
That really get under your skin, so that could have played into it.
Well, then, good luck going to Oregon. But, I mean, to me, what stands out is, like, that game on its own, it's disappointing, but what's problematic is that you look at the schedule, and UW is not going to be favored to win again until Wazoo comes to town at the very end of February. So that's the issue. So this week you go on the road to Colorado and Utah, which is a difficult stretch on the road. Then you've got Cal and Stanford at home after that, and then on the road again for Oregon and Oregon State. That's six games where you'll probably get some of those, but you're not going to be favored in any one of them. And you wanted to build up build a little leeway going into that. If you could be 6-3, you'd have some flexibility to lose some of those games and still be in the mix in the middle of the Pac-12.
It was definitely a deflating loss, and I don't think there was much NCAA tournament steam building there, but there was some,
that
right?
crushed it.
I think that really kind
you
of...
You thought there was more than I did.
Well, I thought that there might have been some. There was the possibility of NCAA tournament
steam
building.
The makings of makings.
Yes.
This hurt our RPI, though, didn't it, by listening to...
Well, every game counts in the RPI the same amount, so really... How you stagger your wins or losses doesn't matter a ton, but you to even be in the conversation, I think you have to win at least 11 Pac-12 games, maybe 12, and that's going to be very difficult, if not impossible now. So this weekend on the road, Colorado has not been the same team since losing Spencer Dinwiddie to the torn ACL that he suffered here in Seattle at Heck Ed, but they have gone 3-1 at home. They're only lost to UCLA. They beat Wazoo narrowly tonight.
I think the Colorado game will be tough just because of the altitude. I think we always have a tough time at Colorado, and they have I think they have a big home advantage because of where they play.
Yeah, I think that's what makes this trip really difficult is the altitude at both of those locations. So, you know, Colorado is going to be tough to beat on the road in any scenario. And then Utah is playing pretty good basketball, especially at home. Their only home loss this year, they're 3-1. Their only home loss was to Oregon by 2 points in overtime in the opener.
And didn't we only narrowly beat them when we first played them, I think?
Yeah, I mean, I think Utah, if you look at advanced stats, has been a much better team over the course of the season. So that could get a little bit ugly. They're the hard luck team in the Pac-12. Every single loss of theirs has been by single digits and a bunch by 2, 3, 4, those kind of margins. They could be a lot higher in the conference than they are.
Any prospective chances of winning one or both or none of those games?
I would say your chances of winning both are maybe 10%. Your chances of splitting are 30-40%. And
that's
your chance of getting swept
than
is 50-60.
Interesting. So. I mean, I have no real perspective on this. I mean, I haven't paid that much attention to either team. I know that playing against a better team with altitude is never a good sign.
Yeah.
So the chances of winning at Colorado feel pretty slim. There's even a little bit of, you know, the Huskies didn't do anything, but an element of revenge for them losing on our home court here for Colorado. I know that we beat both teams, but I think Colorado more so. I would say that the chances of beating Colorado are pretty slim, but maybe a better chance of beating Utah, like a 35% chance of beating Utah and about a 10% chance of beating Colorado.
So we'll see. If you come back from this weekend at 5-6, it'd be a little tough to muster excitement for the Cal and Stanford because the following weekend after the way they handled UW down in the Bay Area.
And Cal beating Arizona, right?
It's going to be hard to pay attention to Husky basketball for a few months after that. But we will be back next week. Are you going to be in town?
If we record it Tuesday morning, we'll have to record
it. We'll have an NBA All-Star Game preview.
Yeah.
So I'm excited about that, to talk All-Star Game, and then maybe live coverage of you from the NBA All-Star Game.
Perhaps so.
You'll be partying on the streets of New Orleans. Wait, that's where it's at, right?
It is in New Orleans.
Yeah, you always go to the All-Star Game in New Orleans.
Every time it's there, I'm there.
Is there a celebrity game you could get yourself in?
To participate
playing?
In?
Yes.
Well,
yes.
Zach Lowe of Grantland is going to be an assistant coach for the celebrity All-Star
just
game.
About there.
Oh,
Simmons.
Wow.
But the problem is they play the celebrity game right before the rookie game, so you can't go to both of them. They're in different locations.
You can't play in either game or both of them.
I'm going to miss out on the opportunity to watch.
You'll have the chance to sit behind the bench and yell at Zach Lowe to put you in. That's a pretty big honor for Zach Lowe, though. He's the assistant coach.
It's his coaching debut. I think I'm very intrigued to see how it's going to go.
He's calling plays. I remember when you coached our rec basketball team, and it did not go well.
No, but I think that I don't know if the celebrity game players will be any more or less likely to actually pay attention to what you're saying than our team.
I believe I refused to go in one time when you yelled at me to go into a game.
There was also an entire half where one of our teammates thought we were in man and we were in zone or vice versa.
That
was an eye-opener.
Hopefully Zach Lowe was a better coach than you.
It wouldn't take much. That bar is very low.
That's all you need. A clipboard that you can throw on the ground. Maybe track pants that you can tear off so you go into the game. If Zach Lowe puts himself in. So anyway, we'll be back next week with full All-Star Game coverage. And the first week for a very long time that we will not talk about the Seattle Seahawks.
I think we'll probably still find a way to talk about the Seahawks.
I was hoping to kind of wrap up that season. I'm excited to talk about other things. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Bye.